Hey, Martin.
Hey, Christina.
Have you ever watched a baby food commercial? Like a commercial where they feed baby food?
Totally. Yeah. The baby's all chubby and happy.
Yeah. You know how they make the spoon be like a train or like an airplane for the baby?
Yeah.
Can you accurately report to us how fast the spoon was moving towards the baby's mouth in terms of miles per hour?
I think I might have difficulty with that one. No, I don't think I can.
Would it be easier if it was kilometers per hour or what?
I think I would have to say that the units of measurement are not actually my biggest problem.
What about meters per second? Like a physics
problem? Right. Yeah. No, I really appreciate your willingness to be adaptable and to help me out with this. But that again, honestly, I don't think is the problem.
Oh, no, that's horrible. Do you have a poor memory of how fast the airplane / spoon of baby food moves towards baby's mouths?
It's occurring to me right now that my memory is so poor that I totally forgot which study we were doing today. I thought we were doing German spinal scientists.
You vetoed German spinal scientists.
I know.
So now we're doing baby food, airplanes flying towards baby's mouths.
I know. But like, I totally...
You did this.
If you asked me in a court of law, what did we decide we were going to do last time? I 100% would have told you it was German spinal scientists was the decision we came to. But it seems like I'm probably wrong. It seems like we're probably doing memory stuff.
Do you remember?
I have no recollection.
Should we do a podcast about the thing you don't remember?
I guess we probably should.
Yeah. Do you know from that introduction what we're talking about today?
I know that today we're going to be looking at a study that proves that human memory is perfect. So
human memory is perfect and infallible. And you should believe every witness testimony because there are no mistakes.
Yep.
The end.
Oh my God. It seems like today we must be talking about the memory studies, the Loftus, I think it was, memory studies. At least that's
the Loftus memory studies.
That's the name I remember. Yeah.
Yes. Do you want to tell people who we are, since I don't want to tell people who we are?
Yeah. We are Martin and Christina, and this is They Did What to What, a show where we read primary sources about the studies that we evidently don't remember learning about in college. And this week, we are talking about memory studies. And this is one that, if you had asked me, I absolutely would have sworn I remembered.
I remember what room I was sitting in. I remember who my TA was. I remember looking out the window and kind of being bored as I was first taught about this study. But today we're talking about the car crash memory studies, the very famous car crash memory studies from Elizabeth Loftus.
Yeah. So I had the exact opposite experience. This was actually one of the things that I remember being like transformative for me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like hearing about this study, this was one of those moments where, because it so fully and thoroughly challenged like basic assumptions about how we think the world works, my recollection was that basically they discovered that people will swear they remember stuff and they just totally don't. Like just empirically, they are totally unreliable. And I was like, whoa, but wait. If the things we say we remember are unreliable, and yet we have people testifying to the truth of things all the time, you know, whoa, up is down, dogs and cats living together. Like it was like a big moment for whatever, 17, 18 year old me.
How much Law and Order did you watch as a child? any of the spinoffs, any series, any season, how much?
Well, I'm a bit older than you. I don't think there were Laws and Order. Laws and there or were, Order.
Law and Order is from like 1950. It's so old. It is genuinely the oldest running show on television, or the longest running show on television, continuously, the original Law and Order. And then there have been 20 spinoffs. Don't even try to say, oh, there wasn't Law and Order.
I think it started in the 90s.
Absolutely not.
So, like, well, I mean, like, you know, I wasn't like a full-on adult or anything at that point, but yeah, I think it started in like the 90s. I didn't watch a ton of Law and Order as a youth, but I have, of course, seen a bunch of it since it was, yes, on continuously for 40 years. So
you did not obsessively watch reruns of Law and Order is what you're saying?
I didn't, no.
I wonder if that's the big divide of people being like shocked by the study or not shocked by the study is how much Law and Order they've watched already.
Because
I went into it being like, of course you can't believe any witness. Of course you can't rely on memory. People make things up. People lie. People misremember.
Okay.
Fundamentally misremember.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet. Because, yeah, like I said, I thought it was like, everyone just assumes that, like, if you can't trust your own eyes, man, what can you trust, you know?
What can you trust?
Yeah. And so if the thing I remember happening isn't really what happened, like, what is there? And so, I found it. I remember this being like a transformative moment in my probably first year of college. So,
yeah, I remember it in my undergrad psychology class, and I think I was 16 at the time, and I remember it being, they were doing like a greatest hits hour introduction, basically, where the TA for this class, in one class, she talked about this memory study. Yes. She talked about the, if you make a facial position while you think about something, your facial position will influence how you feel about it. She showed the video of the basketball with the gorilla guy going in the background. It was like one after the other, after the other, after the other. Where she's like, okay, next. Okay, next one. Okay, next.
I think our introduction to Loftus was similar. Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like it's kind of a little bit of a disservice, but also at the same time, this original study, the 1974 study, that's like the foundational study, is so short. It's genuinely a 4-5 page article. That this will probably be the shortest episode we ever do.
Oh, wow, okay.
Because I tried to make it short. I tried to only do this study, this foundational 74 study.
Yeah.
But it's too little experiments. It's too like, boop, throwaway experiments. Not throwaway. I didn't mean throwaway. It's too small experiments.
Bite-size.
And then,
bite-size experiments.
Yeah. Bite size. They're little Kit Kat bars. But Loftus went on to have a extensive career in memory, and this is just like the beginning of it.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
So the article we're talking about today is named Reconstruction of Automobile Destruction, colon. Which is such a death metal title. I love it.
There would have been a thrash album in like 1985 called that by, I don't know.
Reconstruction of Automobile Destruction.
Yeah.
An example of the interaction between language and memory. And it was by Elizabeth Loftus and John C. Palmer. And it's in the Journal of Verbal Learning and Verbal Behavior.
Oh, interesting.
Do you read that journal?
No.
Well, you should. It's got this one in it.
Do they still publish? Is this still
a thing? No idea. I don't know if this is like the only article in this journal is Reconstruction of Automobile Destruction. And now we play the game of who was the funding source for this research. So most scientific funding is like National Science Foundation and National Institutes of Health.
Yeah.
Who do you think funded the foundational memory research of our time?
I don't know.
The Urban Mass Transportation Administration.
Oh.
Is the funding source. The Department of Transportation funded this memory study.
Oh, really? Okay. So were they specifically interested then in like finding out about memories of car crashes? Like, is that the motivation?
Yes.
Like they're trying to, okay. Cause I think that was also one of the reasons why this study felt so transformative to me, is because when we heard about it, it was explicitly framed as like being relevant to people remembering and reporting car crashes, like in court.
Yes.
And
I think that's genuinely what this was for.
Yeah.
Or why this happened.
But like that was part of what made it seem so real in some ways, because a lot of these other studies, it's like just, you know, I don't know, a lot of science can be abstract. And so, and so the fact that there was this immediate applicability of this one was part of what made it feel so revelatory. Like, whoa, again, this thing that we just take for granted that like you can report on your own memories is just fake. So this was, funded by the Mass Transit Authority.
Mm-hmm.
And they were trying.
Department of Transportation.
Wow. Okay.
Probably the only study we will ever read that it was funded by the Department of Transportation.
Probably, yeah. Wow.
One thing that I really appreciated and enjoyed about this article was a lot of science articles end with a paragraph saying, like, this research is so big and impactful and can be applied to everything all the time.
Yeah.
And this article, the title of it is An Example of the Interaction Between Language and Memory. So they're not even saying this is a phenomenon. They're not even saying this applies to everything. They are so specific.
This is a model of memory. No, it's just, here's an example.
Car crashes. It's only car crashes. They did such a good job. Because as it's taught now, we're told, like, this applies to all human trial testimony, sure, all witness testimony, all witness accounts.
Yeah, totally.
And their article is two examples, and they're like, yep, we did it. We did two examples. Have two examples.
Wow. This week, I was talking to my students about their so what paragraphs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the end of your paper, you've got to have a so what. And the so what is usually where, someone will make a claim that this transforms our understanding of memory for all times forever in every way possible. And so,
they did not do that.
That's really funny.
You would have given them a D and been like, make your so what statement more impactful.
Yeah. Why do I care? Like, maybe that's what you get for being funded by the Department of Transportation. They have low expectations. They're like, yeah, this is fine. You don't need to.
Good job.
You don't need to sell this.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to sell this. This journal is read by bus drivers.
I don't know. I don't know who reads the journal.
Well, that's true. It was in the Journal of Verbal Learning and Verbal Behavior.
Verbal Learning and Verbal Behavior.
It was just funded by the MCTC.
Department of Transportation.
Whatever. No, MTC. Sorry. I forgot my Minneapolis
MTA?
Civic abbreviations.
Yeah. It was funded by bus drivers for bus drivers. For bus drivers with a specific interest in verbal learning and verbal behavior.
It's a really broad market.
Very broad market. Two people who text each other.
The two linguist nerds on the on the local bus driving circuit.
So their study opens with the question, how accurately... This is a direct quote from the article. How accurately do we remember the details of a complex event like a traffic accident that has happened in our presence? More specifically, how well do we do when asked to estimate some numerical quality, such as how long the accident took, how fast the cars were traveling, or how much time elapsed between the sounding of a horn and the moment of collision? So it's all about car crashes.
Oh my God. All right. Maybe I should just let you talk about the article, but I'm just immediately, all right. I got in a car accident last winter.
How fast were you going?
That's the whole thing. So I was going around a roundabout and someone just like entered the roundabout and ran into the side of my car. And like sometimes in car
accidents. Did they smash into your car?
They did. And like I was sometimes in an accident, you're like, oh my God, you know, it's terrifying. I remember when they hit me, I was like, seriously? Like, what? Because like, I was just driving. I was going pretty slow because it was icy. And they ran right into the side of me. I was like, are you kidding me? Like, what are you doing? And they were going really slow too. So it was just like an inconvenience. But the point is this. When I called the insurance company, they were trying to make me estimate a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, yep.
They're like, so approximately like how long did it take between like, you know, the time you saw them and the time they hit you? And I was like, I have no idea. I told mm-hmm. them, I have no idea how to estimate things like that. I was like, I don't know, less than a minute, I guess. Like, I'm so bad at estimating time that in distance.
Do you refuse on principle to make estimations of time and speed and rate of movement?
I basically did. I was like, I can't tell you that with any reliability. And they're like, you have to. this was most of our conversation was her like trying to make me estimate things. Cause I sent them pictures of the crash. Like, yeah, clearly they ran right the heck into the side of your car. Like there was a police report. There was a police officer right down the street who was like, saw it happen. So like,
did he or she estimate the rate of speed?
She probably did. I don't know. She probably is good at that. Or
no, she's probably not.
You're confident then. Cause I was
she's probably confident.
I was just like, I can't tell you anything. It was less than a minute. I know how long a minute is. And it was less than that. But was it 4 seconds, 3 seconds? I have no idea. So anyway, I'm sure I'm jumping way ahead, but like just this opening paragraph gave me this flashback / anxiety memory of talking to an insurance adjuster being like, I have no clue how fast or how long things, you know, took.
You can send this article to your insurance adjuster and say, I shouldn't tell you any words because they will be influenced by the words of that people said around me, basically. Spoiler alert. So their opening question is, how well can we assess things? How well can we assess rate of speed? How well can we assess an accident? Yeah. How well can we assess what actually happened?
Yeah.
And they say that in the literature, it's been shown multiple times that people inaccurately report numbers. So distance, time, speed, movement, that sort of thing. People aren't good at estimating that.
Oh, okay.
And it's also very difficult to estimate the duration of an event. So if you're bored, you think something lasts 5 hours.
Totally.
If you're really engaged and interested, it flies by. Yeah. It goes by in a flash, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And previous reports have shown, previous to 1974, when this article came out, showed that automobile accidents result in a huge variation from one witness to another witness. So you can have multiple witnesses of an accident and people will say vastly different things, even if they watched the same accident.
Oh, okay.
And one study that maybe we should do an episode on in the future was on Air Force pilots. Oh. The Air Force pilots in this study were told ahead of time, you're going to be asked how fast this plane is going.
Sure.
This car is going. And the car was going 12 miles an hour. Uh-huh. And the Air Force pilots guessed 10 to 50 miles an hour for this 12 mile an hour car. And these are people who, it's their profession to know about speed.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. This is what they do all day.
It's what they do all day is they go fast and then they tell other people how fast they are. Yeah.
And they have to make like important decisions based on this, I assume.
Based on speed, based on how fast they see other people going.
Yeah.
And they were bad at it. They were really, really bad
at it. That sounds super bad.
Not even trained professionals know how fast things move.
Wow.
So Elizabeth's main question is, what are the variables that influence the estimates of speed? So again, if you are being taught this in a classroom, you're told all witness testimony is faulty.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth's question is, what are the variables that influence estimates of speed? And then she goes on to say, this study is just about one possible variable. So not even all of the variables for speed, just one of them. So funny.
Wow. That is so conservative.
Yes, very conservative. And the study that we're talking about today investigates the variable that is the phrasing of the question used to elicit the speed judgment. So not how well did you see the accident, anything like that, but just the person asking you how fast was the car going right. for the car crash.
Oh, wow.
Their phrasing has an influence on the speed determination.
Oh, cool. Okay, yeah.
And the least conservative portion of this is Dr. Loftus mentions a leading question, and that's a question that suggests to a witness what the answer is or leads the witness to the desired answer. So again, for a car crash, if there was a police officer asking you a question, if they phrased the question in different ways, would that influence how you answered
right,
the question?
Right, right. Oh, very cool. All right. Interesting.
So we're at study number one. And for this study, the subjects were shown films of traffic accidents. And this was 1974. So when they say films,
yes.
they mean films.
Film strips of traffic
Film accidents. Strips of a traffic accidents. And then they answer questions about the accidents, including the speed of the vehicle. But the speed question has different phrasing.
Oh, okay.
So one of the phrasing is, quote, about how fast were the cars going when they hit each other?
Uh-huh.
Or how fast were the cars going when they smashed into
oh,
each other?
Oh, okay.
So when they hit each other versus smashed into
right.
each other. And it is now psychology study speculation hour. Martin, who do you think were the subjects for this study?
I'm guessing it's a class of undergraduates taking intro to psychology, and they're getting extra credit.
You don't think it's urban? What degree do you get to become an urban planner?
No, I do not think it's 40 urban planners from New Haven, Connecticut.
40 urban planners.
Or 40, well, no, urban planners. I always think of Paris for urban planners. So, I don't know. Like, you know, the Haussmann, the guy who redesigned Paris to keep mm-hmm. the communists from having revolutions anymore. I imagine that most people, when they think of urban planning, don't think of counter-revolutionaries.
No, I think they think of big automobile.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But that's me. Or maybe, like, what's the guy in New York? Mosley? The guy who put freeways...
Moses,
yeah. A guy who put freeways through black neighborhoods. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm just saying Moses. I don't think that's actually, I don't know that that's his name. I'm just saying Moses.
Because
I know the name Moses. He parted the sea. He parted the neighborhoods, right?
I'm going to look up piece of shit urban planner.
You don't think that the subjects were 40 people who walked into the Department of Transportation building in Washington, D.C.?
Oh, my God. Was it?
No, I wish it was. It was 45 students.
So I was imagining, because, like, who's walking into that office? It's like, it's actually just people who are lost. Just like, hey, I was trying to pick up my mail. We don't have your mail, but hey, do you want to be in a study?
My car got towed. Do you know where my car is?
Which, honestly, I think probably would be a better, like, a more generalizable Absolutely. Sample.
100%. Or would it be? Because I don't know. My car's been towed 2 to 3 times.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I'm representative of anyone.
Sure, but I think selecting for confused people is, like, maybe better than selecting for people who registered for intro to psychology, just in terms of, like, you know, again,
they registered and they made it to the class.
Yeah, like,
right?
Yeah, that is so. I do this thing, and I have to hold off until, like, the midpoint of the semester, where I make fun of people who have talents that I don't. So, like, we were making fun of decathletes in class the other day, because whatever, nerd, way to be dedicated or whatever.
Is decathletes the one where they ski and then they shoot things?
That's biathlon.
Biathletes, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And then pentathlons are always, like officer games. So, like, they tend to involve the skills that military officers need. So it's usually, like, horse riding and wrestling.
Well, you can make fun of them for not being able to do speed estimations.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, but again, the thing is, I only make fun of people who are actually good at something. And so, so yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, yeah, people who made it to class on time. So I would make fun of
people
them.
People who made it to class.
I would make fun of them as a bunch of nerds because I certainly wasn't. Yeah, I'm going to sidetrack you for just another second here. About 5 minutes ago, you said that you were taking a first year intro psychology class when you were 16.
I'm very smart, Martin.
Are you?
I'm a doctor. I'm a doctor of philosophy. I'm a very smart person.
Okay. Well, like I said, it is my practice to bully people who are better than me. So
I drove from the suburbs to class to be told about this study when I was 16.
When you were 16 years old?
In my grandma's Firebird. You know those cars that the engine is like five times as long as the car? In my grandma's Firebird, I drove from the suburbs to campus and heard about the study.
This would be the part where I made fun of you for being, oh, look at me. I'm Christina. I'm good at school or whatever.
I will point out that we are both doctors of philosophy.
We are now.
Anything you say to me, what is it? It bounces. I'm rubber, you're glue. Yep. It bounces off me and sticks to you.
It will a little bit eventually. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
point being
that the subjects in this study, the participants were 45 nerds,
who
came to class on time, like a bunch of nerds.
The article does not say if they got extra credit, and they are not specifically psychology students, so it could be even any student.
Right. Just okay.
And they were split into groups of nine. And each group of nine students was shown seven films of traffic accidents. And the films were borrowed from the Evergreen Safety Council and the Seattle Police Department. The films were 5 to 30 seconds long. So each group watched all seven films of the traffic accidents. Mm-hmm. And then they were given a questionnaire. And the article doesn't even tell us all of the questions on the questionnaire.
Okay.
But there's one question that's different between the different groups.
Sure.
And the verb is the only thing that's different.
Oh, wow.
So nine were asked about how fast were the cars going when they hit each other. Mm-hmm. And the other verbs were smashed into each other, collided into each other, bumped into each other, or contacted each other.
Oh, okay.
And of those verbs I just said, I'll read them one more time. I want you to pick the fastest verb.
Okay.
So we have more. Bumped, contacted, smashed, collided, and hit.
Smashed has to be the fastest.
Smashed.
Yeah. Smashed and collided are the fast ones. And then like bumped and contacted are definitely slow ones.
What is the rate of speed of a colliding car?
You can't make me answer that. You're not my insurance adjuster.
Well, lucky for you, we have data. We have table one.
Let's look at, if I had had this, I could have just made the insurance adjuster look at table one and save myself a bunch of time.
Mm-hmm. So table one is hilarious because it's just the list of the verb. Smashed, collided, bumped, hit, contacted.
Whoa, hit was faster than bumped?
No, you don't know how to read graphs. You somehow made it through school without knowing how to read tables and graphs.
What?
So the mean speed estimate, you said hit was faster than bumped, hit is 34 miles per hour.
I meant slower. I just spoke wrong. Sorry. I can tell that 38 is bigger than 34. I'm not a quantitative scholar, but I do have that down.
You're right. I shouldn't make fun of qualitative scholarship. So our fastest verb is smashed, and the students who were asked smashed, how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other, guessed 40.8 miles per hour.
Yes.
And collided was 39 miles per hour.
Yeah.
Bumped was 38 miles per hour. hit was 34 miles per hour, and contacted was 31.8
All right.
miles per hour.
Yeah, so I'm just surprised that bumped seems like it must be slower than hit to me. But what do I know? I'm not one of 45 college students in 1974.
Yeah, I wonder if there was like some cultural...
Right?
Like, was there a song called like Do the Bump
something? Yeah, yeah.
That was like really, really fast.
Yeah, yeah.
It had a high beats per minute.
Yeah, right.
And that impacted the... Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We need to replicate this study ASAP.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that's interesting is they don't tell us really how fast the cars were going in the different films.
Oh, wow.
And they do stats off screen, and then they come back on screen and they say, our stats prove that it totally doesn't matter how fast the cars were going. So they don't actually take into account how fast the cars were going.
Yeah.
Or the deviation
right.
of speed
right.
from the film to the observation, to the guess. They say, we have multiple factors. One factor is how fast the car was going.
Sure.
And the other factor is the verb. And the verb contributes more to the estimation than how fast the car was actually going.
Okay. All right. But yeah, but it is weird that they wouldn't give you the raw data.
If this was published in the year of our Lord 2024, yeah. there would be a link to all of the films.
Right? Yeah.
And you could watch the films yourself. And it would tell you exactly how fast the cars were going. It would have a picture of the speedometer, right. all of those things.
I do remember, and I don't know if this was like actual footage or something, but I do remember... Like what? When we were presented with this study, I remember like a still of some grainy ass 1974 car crash footage, and like that might have just been like something the textbook threw in, you know. As we learned with Pavlov, right? Sometimes the textbooks just throw a bell in there for no reason.
But, whatever they were.
Yeah, but I do remember seeing like a still image of some super grainy 1974 car crash. Footage.
Do you remember what kind of car it was? What was the model?
Absolutely not.
If I gave a suggestive verb in my question, would that influence what model you said it was?
Do you know that I don't know anything about car models?
I also don't know anything about car models.
I learned pretty recently that sometimes the symbols on the front of a car tell you what make or model they are.
Unless they're lying to you.
Like evidently one of those little symbols means like Honda, and like another one tells you it's a Ford. I thought they were just
and Tesla.
Yeah. I thought these were all just like decorations. Just like that. This one has like a fancy little
guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Like a little off center, blue, cross. And like, that means it's a Ford, I guess. But I thought it was just a decoration. So I know nothing about cars. I just absolutely nothing.
You might not be the appropriate audience for this car crash research study.
Almost certainly not.
So their conclusion for experiment one was, quote, the results of this experiment indicate that the form of a question, in this case, changes in a single word, can markedly and systematically affect a witness's answer to that question.
Mm-hmm.
And from this experiment, they're left with two possible interpretations of this finding. And the first is that different speed estimates result from a response bias factor. And the example they give is, a subject is uncertain about whether to say 30 or 40 miles per hour, and the verb influences his decision.
Right.
His response to the higher estimate as compared to the lower. So that they're saying that the witnesses would have two verbs that they, or 2 miles per hour they think could be correct.
Got it.
And the question influences them to pick the higher one.
Right. Right. Okay.
And the second interpretation is that the question causes a change in the subject's memory.
Oh.
So it's not that they're holding a static memory, but that the question itself and the word itself changes what the person remembers about the car accident.
Oh, cool. Okay.
So the two interpretations, again, are number one, the verb or the forming of the question helps someone select from possible choices, right. But they have that static memory.
Right.
Or
right.
The memory is fluid and is actually influenced by the question.
Wow. Okay. Oh, that's very cool. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so presumably they're going to do another study to try to determine which of these two interpretations is more plausible?
Yeah, we're already in the home stretch. We're already on experiment 2 of 2. So in the second case, in the case where memory is actually affected by the verb that's being used,
yeah.
A subject might have sort of implanted memories of other details that didn't actually occur, but would be details that would be congruous with a higher speed.
Oh, okay.
For smashed or hit,
yeah.
or the higher speed verbs.
Right, okay.
So we're getting to our big memory study, not just an estimation of speed study, but a memory study.
Yeah.
And we're on to experiment 2. Who do you think the subjects were for experiment 2?
Presumably 45 bus drivers who came in to pick up their paychecks at the Washington, D.C. Department of Transportation. Yeah.
So I don't know if you know this, but the Department of Transportation is rolling in money, absolutely rolling.
Yeah.
Or students are free. It's one of those two. Because experiment 2 has 150
Whoa.
Subjects.
Seriously?
So many, yeah.
So my colleagues who do quantitative experiments, they're constantly asking for access to the low-hanging fruit that is my introduction to public speaking class.
Mm-hmm.
200 students just sitting there.
With thoughts in their brains.
With thoughts in their brains, just hungry for extra credit. Like 150 is, wow.
Quite a few, yeah. So these 150 students were also shown a film of a car accident.
Yeah.
And this film was followed by a questionnaire. The film was 1 minute and the accident itself was only 4 seconds of the 1 minute.
Oh, okay.
And the first part of the questionnaire was the students were just asked to describe the accident in a freestyle written response. So write down what you remember about the accident.
Sure.
They don't actually include any responses. They don't say what any of the students said.
Sure, why? What?
Again, if this was published in 2024, we would have a link to a database that had all of the responses.
Yeah, but it's 1974, so like, I don't know, whatever. They wrote some stuff. Who cares?
They wrote stuff down. Who cares? Yeah. Probably they shredded that page. That page of the questionnaire, because they're like, that's not what we're asking. Who cares? So of these 150, we have 3 groups with 50 students. The first group was asked, quote, about how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other, which if you remember, smashed was our fastest verb, 40 miles per hour. And then the second group of students was asked, about how fast were the cars going when they hit each other? And hit is only a 34 mile per hour verb. It's not even close to 40 miles per hour.
It couldn't be further away.
Couldn't be further
34?
Mm-hmm. And then the last 50 students were not asked about the speed of the cars at all. So we have a control group that wasn't asked about the speed. And then we have how fast were the cars going when they hit for 50 students. And how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other for 50 students?
And the last 50, so they didn't. They were just given the option of responding about speed or not.
No, there were like 10. They were given the freestyle, like write down your thoughts about this accident, and then they were asked other questions. But again, this article doesn't really tell us what the other questions were.
Right.
And then some of them were asked that questions, and the last 50 just had one fewer question.
I see.
On their questionnaire.
Huh. So it turns out that your local transit commission doesn't have very high standards for scientific rigor. Is that one of the things we're learning from this?
To defend Dr. Daftis, this is one study that she did out of decades of memory studies.
Yes, yes.
And she is a foremost memory researcher, yeah. And she did a lot of really cool stuff after this. This is just a short little study. I don't know why this study is so famous. I genuinely don't understand. Because my understanding is that she did a ton of other work. I don't know if this is just like, this is the first one, therefore everyone cites this. But this study has like 1,000 citations. It's taught all the time. Psychology, every psychology student knows the study or has been told about the study.
Totally. I mean, I wonder if to some extent, and again, maybe you're going to say more about this later, but to some extent, I wonder if it is just that really clever question she asks as she kind of frames out two possible interpretations. She's kind of framing out on some level, like two paradigms for understanding how memory works, you know, how memory is, how memory is constructed in a moment. It's not a neutral sort of thing. And so, I could see that being formative just in the fact that it is, I guess, like I said, you know, kind of paradigm defining.
Yeah. And she goes on to do a lot of work in memory and really builds that model. Mm. And the spoiler alert for this study is that words absolutely update what your memory of a situation is.
Oh, cool.
So I'll talk about the model at the end after we finish experiment two, but it's really, really cool. And she does good work. We are not slandering the good name of Dr. Loftus.
Yes.
So experiment two, they were shown the film. They were immediately asked the questionnaire after the film. And then the real study is 1 week later.
Oh.
The subjects returned and they didn't watch the film again. So they have no updated knowledge. All they have is their memory. And they were again asked a series of questions about the accident. So if you were in like an insurance situation, you might not talk to your insurance agent for a week after the accident happens. So the main question of this study is, quote, did you see any broken glass? And the answer is yes or no.
Oh, wow.
And that's it.
Okay.
That question was in a list of 10 questions and it was in a random order in the list. But the thing that they cared about and the thing they did stats on was, did you see any broken glass? So again, there are 9 other questions. We don't know what the 9 other questions are. The only question that the formidable Dr. Loftus cares about is, did you see any broken glass? The accident itself in the film didn't have any broken glass. Yeah. But broken glass would be consistent with a higher speed.
Right.
So her hypothesis was subjects who were asked smashed would report broken glass more than subjects who were asked hit.
Totally.
Versus subjects who were not asked about the speed at all.
Got it.
And we have table two, which was the distribution of yes and no responses to the question, did you see any broken glass? And the very simple, straightforward result is that a statistically different rate of answering yes was seen in people who were asked smashed versus hit. So if the original questionnaire had the word smashed in it, then 1 week later, those people would be more likely to say yes to was there broken glass as compared to people who were asked hit or people who were not asked anything.
Cool. Okay.
So of 50 people in each group, 7 said yes for broken glass in the hit condition, 6 in the control condition, so basically exactly
that's
the same.
Kind of the same, yeah.
And 16 out of the 50 said yes in the smashed condition.
So that's twice as many people. That's
twice as many people. It's more than twice as many people.
Right, yeah, and that's... It's probably good that it's that big a difference because 150 students is a lot of, that's a lot of undergrads to wrangle. That's a lot of, you know, that's a whole pocket full of extra credit points.
Yeah.
But each group, that's actually not a really, that's not a very big absolute number. That's 9 people different. So like, yeah, it's good that it's like fully twice as much, because otherwise, yeah, I would have some doubts about the significance of those differences.
Yeah. And remember, the accident itself was only 4 seconds.
Oh, right.
So they're being asked about 4 seconds of a film that they saw a week ago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They were also asked about miles per hour, and the subjects who were initially asked smashed said 10.46 miles per hour, and the subjects who were asked hit was 8 miles per hour. Oh. So 2 miles per hour different, 2.5 miles per hour different, and that was statistically different, P less than 0.05.
Oh, all right. I guess. Right, but that's interesting. So they both remember it being slower, and they remember broken glass. Mm-hmm. at a statistically significantly higher rate. Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
And then we have table three. And table three, it's a lot of things that would be difficult to verbally explain with no visual aid. Yeah. But it boils down to concluding that the higher speed estimate alone isn't what accounts for the memory of broken glass.
Oh.
So if you remember, the smashed people said 10.5 miles per hour.
Yes.
The hit people said 8, and they do stats for probability.
Uh-huh.
So they have like probability of speed versus probability of smash versus probability of saying yes. And their stats conclude that it's not because of the higher estimation of miles per hour. It's the verb.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And you can read the paper. It's in the paper. The paper is only four pages long. But I don't think it would be interesting for me to sit here and talk through the stats that they did for concluding that it was the verb and not the miles per hour estimation that contributed to saying yes to was there broken glass.
Right, because the speeds alone were not as predictive of whether they said yes as the verb was. Or as the verb plus the speed.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. That's really cool. That's really clever.
Yeah, because they had a wide range of speed estimations.
Yeah.
We have basically they split it out into 1 to 5 miles per hour, 6 to 10 miles per hour, 11 to 15 miles per hour, 16 to 20 miles per hour.
Yeah.
And I do neuropharmacology, so all I talk about are dose response curves, and they essentially have a dose response curve.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Of verbiage,
right? Yeah.
And for every single speed, for every block of miles per hour, the rate of saying yes to broken glass is higher.
Yeah, yeah.
In smashed than versus hit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a short study. It's really simple.
It's really good. It's such a good study.
Super clever.
Yeah.
Wow. I like it.
And that's it. That's all we got.
that's all they did. But what more do they need to do? Mm-hmm. They defined a new model for memory. That's, I don't know. When's the last time you did that?
That's it. Yeah. I haven't done that since last Wednesday.
Oh, really? Oh, so you did get that grant from...
the National Botany Foundation. I wish. Oh, my God.
Wanted you to estimate how fast that flower pot was thrown at your head.
So Dr. Loftus says that experiment 2, quote, provided a demonstration of something that has been known for some time, namely that the way a question is asked can enormously influence the answer that is given, quote. So her proposal, her model building, this is like the beginning of memory modeling, is that there are two kinds of information that go into memory for any event. And the first is information that you get from the event that influences your memory.
Sure.
And the second is information from after the event.
Oh.
So your memory of an event has two parts.
Yeah.
Number one, when it happened.
Yeah.
Number two, after.
Yeah. So the memory isn't locked in the moment it happens. The memory gets constructed over time, from the time it happens, and then for some period afterward.
Yes.
Mm.
Forever afterward, according to this model.
Oh.
Yeah. Information from during and after the event are mixed up together or integrated together. and we recall one memory. So we don't recall a memory of what happened and then a memory of stuff that happened after the event. We remember a single memory that we think is what happened during the event, but that's influenced by other factors.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Cool.
And I love that Elizabeth Loftus says that this has been known for some time, right?
Like, yeah, yeah.
In her discussion, she says, everyone already knew this. Also, here are other studies that show this. And she genuinely did a ton of research into memory. I'm not trying to downplay,
yeah,
but I love how particular and conservative and like,
right,
not boastful. I'm so, yeah, used to boastful papers where someone,
yeah,
says,
yeah,
we solved this, we cured this, I invented this. And we read all of those single author, male author papers.
Right.
Where they say, I invented XYZ.
Right.
I'm the originator of XYZ. Yeah. Only to look into history and see, oh, they're absolutely not the first person to do this.
Or like, they just literally didn't do the thing they said they did. Like,
exactly.
Looking at, yeah, you, John B. Watson.
Yeah.
Or just like,
and Dr. Loftus is like, I read the literature. I know other people have done this. I'm saying this is just an example of something that other people already know.
Yeah.
And her study is a study that everyone sees as this like foundational concept.
I think that's an interesting like rhetorical strategy of kind of downplaying your claims. One of my advisors was really, really good at that. He would write essays that just made these tiny, tiny, tiny little moves a little bit at a time, just going, yeah, so basically I just told you what you already knew, but like if you pieced it back together from the beginning of the article to the end, he had like persuaded you of something wild, you know, and it wasn't like dishonest. The entire thing was just like, look, I'm giving you a little bit of evidence and a little bit of evidence and this kind of, mm-hmm, like, you know, trail of breadcrumbs where by the end you totally were like, yeah, I feel like I always did know this. So yeah, I don't know. I wonder to what extent this is kind of like a rhetorical strategy that Loftus is like either intentionally or unintentionally using, or to what extent she really is just like, I don't know, man, this is obvious, you know, like.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, not revelatory, but it's kind of revelatory of like, look at this field, look at how much work is being done.
Yeah.
I'm putting it together in, yeah, one place.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
But the work is out there.
Okay.
Yeah. Here's where the work is.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's very cool.
And she absolutely made contributions. I'm not saying she only did.
No, of course.
What other people already did.
Right. 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 Yeah.
But in a delightful, delightful study, that's the end of her study. That's it. That's what she has to say, yeah, is here's an example of words impacting memory.
Well done, Elizabeth Loftus.
I would give her an A+. This is, yeah, like such a good article.
Yeah, yeah.
She cited this other article that did a very similar thing from 1935.
Oh, okay.
And this article is so cute. It hurts me. It genuinely hurts me. So it's much longer, and it was published in 1935. So I don't know if you remember our friend Wolfgang Kohler from Gestalt Psychology.
Oh, yeah.
He did the original Kiki Booba.
Yes,
he,
yes,
had the shapes connected to sound,
yes,
that sort of thing.
Yes.
So one of the questions is, when you see shapes, what happens? Or when you hear sounds, what happens?
Oh,
that sort of thing.
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
And this 1935 article is genuinely like heart-wrenchingly adorable because there's three authors and they spend pages and pages talking about the state of the field and arguments that these big names in psychology had with each other.
Oh, okay.
And then they present their study and then they have pages of, we know our study was very bad. We know that there were flaws in our methodology. We know that this could never achieve anything. We're very sorry that we wasted your time reading this article. It was so beautiful. But the gist of what they did is they had this series of 20 shapes. And it was a memory test where they showed the shapes to people and then, uh-huh, people had to draw all 12 shapes. But half of the people were told one name for a shape and half of the people were told the other name for a shape.
Oh.
So for example, one of the shapes is two circles connected with a line in the middle.
Yeah.
And half were told eyeglasses and half were told dumbbell. And then they had to draw the original shape. And what this study found was that the name that you gave the shape influenced how the person drew the shape.
Right.
So if a person was told that that was a dumbbell, they would draw the shape differently than if the person was told it was eyeglasses.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Or they have a squiggly line and half of the people are told it's a 2 and half are told it's an 8. And the people who are told it's a 2 remember 2 and reproduce a 2.
Right.
Versus the people who are told an 8 remember an 8 and reproduce an 8.
So they're like remembering and reproducing the concept rather than the exact visual stimulus.
Exactly. Their memory is influenced by the word that was used to trigger the memory, and that influences their memory of the shape, and it induces them to draw a different shape. So it's a really beautiful study. The name of the study is An Experimental Study of the Effect of Language on the Reproduction of Visually Perceived Form. From 1935. Very good, A+. And it has such a cute diagram of all these different shapes. All right, that's it. So, Martin, do you think this study is specific to speed? Would you generalize this study beyond speed?
Oh, so would their memories be impacted in other ways other than just the speed of a car?
Right. Do you think words impact memory beyond the rate of movement of an automobile?
It sounds like Loftus is not going to make that claim. It sounds like Loftus is going to be very conservative and say no. But I think it's probably fair to make some additional hypotheses that maybe other modalities are impacted other than just speed estimation. Yeah.
And one of the things that Loftus went on to study and to do a lot of writing about was repressed memories.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So I feel like it was the 80s and 90s, there was this huge phenomenon of people going to therapy and their therapist telling them, as a baby, this happened to you. And there would be, obviously, a lot of things happen without evidence. I'm not trying to say you need evidence in order for something to happen. But
totally.
There'd be no evidence of these absolutely wild stories of implanted memory. And these implanted memories would only arise after a person had been seeing a psychologist for many, many years.
Right.
So Loftus went on to effectively argue against the phenomenon of implanted memory using her work, saying the words that a psychologist uses or a psychiatrist uses absolutely influences your memory.
Right.
And would be a root cause of this implanted memory phenomenon.
They are physician caused memories. Iatrogenic. Yeah. I was just trying to remember that word. Yeah. Iatrogenic memories.
Nobody beats me in an iatrogenic memory contest.
Oh, wow. Cool. And that's, so when you said that she started getting into repressed memories, I was kind of scared because that was linked to some not great stuff in the 80s.
Yeah,
exactly. That whole kind of satanic panic, you know, universe, which, as you said, right, in no way, you know, universally denying that bad things happen to some people that they don't remember till later. Absolutely, that happens.
Lack of evidence doesn't mean that something didn't happen.
Totally.
Across the board.
At the same time, the satanic panic was a weird thing where lots of people got excited about remembering things that seemed to have not actually happened. It's very exciting that that Loftus was like, I was worried what you were going to say her contribution was. And like, it's cool that she was like going like, hey, let's see if we can, to what extent we can figure out who actually was injured in the past and who has been swept up in this weird 1980s culture war.
I don't know if she specifically performed research studies, primary studies repressed memory, wrote, my understanding is that she wrote multiple articles and published multiple articles about memory, framing it in the context of words that you hear in the present impact the memories that you have of events that previously happened.
Yeah, totally. That's Elizabeth Loft sounds super cool.
She's probably the best researcher that we've talked about so
right?
far.
Right? Yeah. is this where we discover that, like, most of the data was collected by her grad student who she was also having a romantic relationship with?
No, her original, she lists the funding and then she also thanks Jeffrey Loftus. My assumption is that's like her husband or partner.
Yeah.
Maybe father, maybe brother. I don't know. But she thanks Jeffrey Loftus for many important and helpful comments.
Yeah, that is very
comments.
Generous. I just Googled her, fully aware that, you know, we might just milkshake duck her. But
what is milkshake duck?
It was a Twitter joke. Like, it was the idea that, like, anytime anyone becomes like momentarily famous and people are like, oh, that guy's so cool, it's only a matter of time before it's revealed that they have some horrible dark secret. And so it's like, the joke was like, you know, Duck loves drinking milkshakes. And then like 10 minutes later, you know, turns out the milkshake duck is a Nazi. And like, it's a phrase like to milkshake duck something is like the discovery that this cultural icon turns out to be just like a total piece of crap. So that's what I was fearing. But it turns out Jeffrey, it does seem to, or she does have a spouse named Jeffrey. She's still alive. She's only 79. 1974 seems like so long ago.
Wow. But how quickly have the years gone since 1974?
It depends upon how you ask me. how quickly have the years smashed by?
How quickly have the years contacted each other? About 1 year per year.
I see no evidence that she is secretly a horrible person. So,
fingers crossed.
Womp womp. Immediately after we recorded this, we just did a quick Google search and it turns out she's worked as an expert witness for the defense of some pretty crappy people.
Are you ready for the absolutely, definitely for sure legitimate pop culture reference of the day?
I'm totally ready. I'm so ready. I can almost hear the theme music now.
Definitely legitimate. We need new theme music because the reference today is a song.
Oh. Huh. All right. I will think about coming up with new theme music. What are we talking about?
Fast Car by Tracy Chapman, of course.
Oh, okay. Hey, wouldn't it be weird if somebody covered that song?
Oh my God,
that hasn't been done in a while. Yeah, I'll just do a cover of it. I think that's what we can do for the theme music. Cool. All right. Good plan.
So the song is Fast Car by Tracy Chapman, and it is already very obvious why this is the incredibly, totally legitimate pop culture reference.
Yeah.
Definitely, for sure, legitimate pop culture reference of the day. But Tracy Chapman is a phenomenal human being, phenomenal woman. Yeah. She reads the Department of Transportation newsletter that comes out every month, twice a month.
Undoubtedly.
Yes. So in 1974, she read the Department of Transportation newsletter about this study. And she said,
I'm sure of it.
Okay, I will write a song about this study because of how important and impactful this study is. So she wrote Fast Car, and it's about how fast cars go. And that's the reference. And it includes lyrics such as, "You got a fast car. Is it fast enough so you can fly away?"
And again, if she had asked instead, You've got a fast car. Is it fast enough to smash into
another car?
Yeah. Then we would have understood the relative speed of the cars mm-hmm. in her song totally mm-hmm. differently.
We can't calculate where Tracy Chapman moved from and to in this song. She talks about moving. No. Because we don't know the rate of speed, we don't know like the diameter of how far she could have gone.
Right. From a given central point.
From a given central point. Yeah.
We have neither direction nor speed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's...
It's going to be on her follow-up song, probably.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is that she wrote that song before we had things like Google Maps. So now we could just, like, you know, we could just follow her movements that way. We would know how fast she was going and exactly where she was.
Well, you don't need Google Maps because you can just ask her, Tracy, what verb would best describe the rate of speed of this car? And then she would answer, and then you could look up in table one the rate conversion from the verb that she chose.
But don't we run into the problem of our asking the question will change her memory of where it was that she was going?
So we need 150 Tracy Chapmans.
All taking intro psych courses. All of whom want extra credit.
Mm-hmm. And we ask 50 of them. No questions. We ask 50 of them one verb and 50 of them another verb.
Yeah, that sounds great. I would be very happy with a class of 150 Tracy Chapmans.
There would be literally no better class in the world. It would be the best class.
I think that is that seems very true to me. Mm-hmm. That's my new goal. My new goal is to recruit 150 Tracy Chapman to.
The other thing you could do, assuming infinite universes with infinite possibilities. You can just open rooms, and the possibility that the room contains 150 Tracy Chapmans exists.
Yep.
So if you open enough doors, eventually there will also be a room that has 150 Newt Gingriches. Yes. So the goal is to find the Tracy Chapman
before the Newt Gingrich.
Before the Newt Gingrich,
I'm not sure I'm willing to take the chance, actually, now that you put it that way. Mm.
But 150 Tracy Chapmans, like what could be better?
It really is. It's a big reward. It's a big reward.
Mm-hmm. Is there a better pop culture reference of the day you can think of?
There isn't. No, that's it. Mm-hmm. That's the one. Yep. Well done.
And now
I'll see what I can do about an alternate theme song.
Now we all get to go put on Fast Car by Tracy Chapman and just sort of bask in how good that song is.
Terrific.
Well, that's it. That's all we got.
Cool. Wow. This was a very concise study, but also super satisfying.
Mm-hmm. She did a really incredible job.
And satisfying, even though there was all this stuff just kind of left out. Like there wasn't that much to it. She left out fully 70% of the data.
Oh, she left out... She took one question out of 20 questions.
That's right. Yeah, it was even worse than one out of 20. And then on the other one, one out of 10. Like, we don't know any of these questions were.
To be fair to her, we would have been so distracted by that, we wouldn't have been focused on the actual point. We would have been arguing over p-values of other questions.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's so simple. And I think this is the thing that is, I think I mentioned this before, like when I was a young psychology student, not as young as you, but when I was a young psychology student, I remember asking the teacher about like, isn't there something about like studies that are written elegantly or poetically that really drives, isn't part of the discipline driven just by the fact that some authors write really well or just do a really good job with the report. And this person sort of denied that was true, saying, no, it's about the science. It's about the, it's about the data. Mm-hmm. And I was not convinced by that, which is, again, why I became a comm studies scholar, not a psychologist, partially. It's like, no, I think the language matters a lot. And I think this is another great example where, it's not the most thorough study. It's just so elegant.
It's really well done, yeah. And it's not even pretending to be a study. It's an example. She calls it an example.
Yeah, right. Yeah, 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 yeah.
An example of the interaction between language and memory. Do we get to talk about spinal cords next week?
Don't ask me. I clearly have...
Do you have any memory?
My memory is worse than one of 150 undergrads.
No, your memory is worse than 50 Air Force pilots being asked about the speed of a car.
My memory is just as good as one of 45 random people who walked into a bus terminal in Washington, D.C. asking where their car was. So we're doing German spinal scientists next week?
There's no other option. We have
okay.
to.
Well, there were other options.
To. There are no other options.
Okay. German spinal scientists it is. So we're going back in time.
Going back in time. 1880. Is it 1880 wow. or 1890?
It was
18 yeah. blah, 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 blah. To Germany, to two men with the same name injecting each other with the same drug and literally staying up all night tickling each other and then writing about it and then sending the letters away to another German man to publish in his German newspaper. And we get to read about it.
I don't know how to say this in a way that I don't want you to take this badly.
I'm already taking it badly.
But this study, I get why you in particular want to read this study. And I don't mean that in any bad way at all. But it just makes entire sense to me that you, of all people, would want to read this study.
Because it's objectively the best study that's ever been done. Objectively.
That's what I meant, obviously.
Objectively.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Join us next week for Old German Guys. What is this SNL, the Wild and Crazy Guys? We're too wild. Yeah. This is the part of the podcast where we sprockets.
All right.
Okay, goodbye.
I was kind of confused with that opening, I gotta say, because I was like, what does this have to do with German spinal scientists? I seriously thought we were doing German spinal scientists.
You fully vetoed it. It is recorded.
I'm sure it is.
We have proof.
I'm sure it is, but again.
You said, oh, so boring. Spinal anesthesia? Who cares?
I know. I remember that, and then I very clearly remember us then deciding, but we're going to do it anyways.
We'll do it next time.